Welcome back to Emerge. Today's episode is with Andrew Taggart. Andrew is a rare bird of human being who has seemed to make a living for himself out of the art of philosophy. And it's actually not hard to see why. Having a conversation with Andrew is simply a beautiful experience. As I share in the podcast, I first spoke with Andrew when he was interviewing me for an article he was writing, and just so much appreciated his capacity to create an open space of inquiry, which really is a lot of what this show is attempting to do and what I am wanting to cultivate in myself as a capacity. So it's really a joy to get to connect with Andrew and talk about his article, Psychotechnologies of Self-Transformation. Discovered so many symmetries in our thinking and orientation, and I think we got into some really clear, beautiful, cool, deep water together. And even as I re-listen to this episode, it feels kind of like a spiritual balm for me. And I think that if you feel at all panicked about the state of the world right now, as maybe a very reasonable way to feel, I would encourage you to take a little bit of space and give a listen to this conversation. It may be the medicine that is needed right now is that which perhaps the words are pointing to, but more the flavor, the scent of this conversation. So I haven't been mentioning this, but for some reason I will with this episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Monastic Academy. It's where I live and where I work. It wouldn't be possible for me to do this inquiry with the level of integrity that I'm at least attempting to bring to it if I weren't being given the space and the food and the housing to do it by the Monastic Academy. It's not the only work I do here at Maple, but it's a big part. It takes a lot of my time. And so if you appreciate this podcast and want to learn more about the Monastic Academy and perhaps how you can support the Monastic Academy's mission, you can check out www.monasticacademy.com. Okay, without further ado, here is my conversation with Andrew Taggart. I was thinking a little bit last night and this morning during meditation when I was supposed to be meditating about this conversation and what was alive for me in it. I think the thing that feels most up and why I felt so interested in talking with you for the podcast is the conversation that we previously had. You were doing research for an article, I think for a new magazine. Is it called The New Modality?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you had reached out to me. I think you'd heard about the Monastic Academy through Peter Lindbergh, and you reached out to talk to me. And just the quality of that conversation and the sort of space of inquiry that you created there really touched me. And I love speaking with people who are able to create those kinds of conversational spaces. And so I think in the back of my mind, I was kind of looking for an excuse to have you on the show since then. And then recently, I read your article that's called Psychotechnologies of Self-Transformation. And you know, I was struck by how similar your sort of how it is that you see, quote unquote, the problem right now. And then, so that was wonderful, but not too uncommon because people in our milieu, you know, use words like psychotechnologies and that acknowledge that there's some kind of like meta crisis happening on the planet right now. But then that you also identified like liberal humanism as being a primary obstacle. I was very struck by that because I think that's less common. that's seen as something that actually kind of needs to be unwound through these psychotechnologies. Mm-hmm. And so all of that kind of came together. And I was like, oh, I need to speak with Andrew, especially as I embark on this new chapter of the podcast where I'm really taking a deep look at human transformation. And so, yeah, I thought that maybe we could, I could talk to you and you could share a bit about that article and we could sort of build that conceptual territory together, me asking you questions and so on. And then from there, I think we can just play. And I imagine we could do that for the foreseeable future and it would be interesting and fun and useful. Maybe we can start by, I could ask, what would you say the main sort of thesis or point you were trying to get across with that psychotechnologies of self-transformation article? What were you trying to say?
There are two starting points that are only hinted at in the article. And I think these are scintillating examples. The first is very near and dear to my heart. I some time ago watched the documentary "Won't You Be My Neighbor," which features the late Fred Rogers. I don't know much about the life of the late Fred Rogers apart from that documentary, but I was very moved by it, moved to the point of tears. And I've certainly wondered since then, and wondering is a little bit tepid of a word here. Why is it the case that we're not kinder to one another, let alone to all sentient beings? It seems that he was able to live the gospel of love. Love thy neighbor as thyself. It's almost making me want to cry now. Why are human beings not yet able to love one another and be kind unto one another, let alone, again, to all sentient life? That was one starting point for the article, even though I didn't include it in the talk. The other starting point is included, but somewhat obliquely. Namely, we know, notwithstanding climate change deniers and notwithstanding apologists for the view that climate change is a, quote, natural cycle, that climate change is real and human-caused. I've just said all that, and in the talk I put forward a kind of long quote in which facts are stated. And yeah, what strikes me, and this is also very moving to me and so sad, is that I can say all that, or one can say all that, and it can make no difference whatsoever in terms of how it touches our hearts. So it seems clear that we should be able to love one another and be kind unto one another. And it also seems clear that we should be able to love the earth that surrounds us, that infuses our lives, the earth with which we participate. One doesn't even have to be an animist to think that that's true. But we aren't doing so. And it seems as if we're not yet able to. It's out of those concerns that I began to think about. Those are the primary kind of punchy concerns that I began to think about the larger historical and cosmological questions with a view to making a strong case for a different kind of education, which would be centered on life practices or an ecology of practices or psychotechnologies.
Beautiful. And so, I'm noticing again a lot of symmetries in our explorations. You know, I essentially through this podcast, I've come to the place where it's quite clear that I want to say this without giving a sense of blame, but that the root of that which is destroying the planet now is the human mind. And therefore, what is called for is a new kind of education that can produce a new kind of human who, as you say, might be able to both be kind to other humans, but mm-hmm. also take care of this planet. And there's quite a sense of, at least for me, where I'm sitting, quite a sense of urgency with mm-hmm. this. You know, this morning we had announcements during breakfast here at Maple, the monastery, and I shared that, you know, we were on retreat for the last week, but coming out of retreat that Australia is on fire, you know, 16 million acres of forest, 3 times larger fire than California, 500 million, half a billion animal lives have just been snuffed out because of this newest, most recent embodiment of the climate crisis. And so I love that you're approaching this in the same way. And I'm wondering, like, maybe a good place to start is like, what's the next step? So you've been wondering this, you're presenting this ecology of practices, or at least this frame of an ecology of practices. Like, where do we go next? Where's a good place to go?
I think maybe that's something that you and I can try to understand throughout the course of this conversation. But first, I know that in the last question, you asked me a bit about humanism. So let me say something about what could be a root cause. I take it as axiomatic that any genuine culture, it's an axiom, so it can be questioned, but I think it's fundamental that any genuine culture consists of 3 fundamental elements or dimensions. I'm borrowing this from the writings of the late Ramon Panikkar, who was a theologian, philosopher, and even scientist of a sort. And he suggests that any genuine culture would consist of a cosmological understanding, or a cosmos, of theos, some idea of divinity, and of anthropos, or some idea of humankind, and we might want to expand that in some idea of sentient life. And the idea then would be that a genuine coherent culture would be able to fundamentally integrate all those dimensions or elements, you might say, in a beautiful manner. Too quickly it could be said, however, that in modernity we have behind our backs witnessed the demise of cosmos and divinity, with the consequence that what has arisen is the slogan, man is the measure of all things. I think it's hard still to see that in my understanding. It's hard because we haven't known what it's like to open one's eyes to a cosmos, to to a living, palpable organism that is coherent, well-ordered, beautiful, all-encompassing, and is therefore not over and against we understand ourselves, but in and through which we are. There is no dualism here, properly understood. So on this understanding, humanism makes possible, or is one of the root causes that makes possible the story you just told us about Australia burning. But I don't yet know how to, I'm getting, coming around to your question about what next steps are, but I don't yet know how to describe in the fullest possible way what it feels like to be living in the regime of humanism. We open our eyes in the morning, let's suppose we're not enlightened or greatly enlightened, or we haven't just been on retreat, and we see objects and others that are seemingly separate from us, and we seem to believe that we have a separate sense of self, or that we are a separate self-standing self. And what's more, we get caught up in what I call the endless human dramas. That is, our minds are oriented almost always to human thoughts, human feelings, human sensations. I'm using that double sense. That is, they are the thoughts that occur quote unquote to me, but they're also thoughts typically of or about me or other humans. There are feelings that occur to me, such as, let's say, sadness, but they are typically right. the sadness I feel in relation to another human, and so on and so forth. So if you begin to observe thoughts, feelings, sensations, perceptions, like, you begin to notice the taint or the tint of humanism. And that seems to be the self-enclosed, humanistically understood world, the world that social media requires in order for it to get off the ground. So that's a way of describing, it's a different way of describing the predicament from a different point of view. I'm wondering what you think are some steps that could be taken.
Yeah, well, one thing that comes up for me too is like you point to humanism, which I think is well seen. I very strongly agree with that, and it has only been through a lot of stubbornness on my part, like overcoming a lot of stubbornness and arrogance on my part, that I think I'm able to see the limitations of humanism. Like, I'm very grateful for my teacher who kind of held my feet to the fire in terms of helping me get over myself. Not that I am, you know, don't wake up in the morning and have kind of narcissistic, self-enclosed world before me, but still I have an aspiration now. But the other component, I'd be curious to hear what you think of this, is liberalism, right? And this is something that I think I didn't see as much in your article, but something that's been up for me a lot, and it comes to me both by way of Soryu, the teacher here, as well as Joe Edelman, who's a wonderful thinker in Berlin who I've been speaking with and who I've interviewed on the show, but that liberalism has this idea that human beings, you can kind of read human beings according to their preferences or maybe their goals. And that's a kind of vision of what the human being is, right? And it fuses then with humanism because, and almost like sanctifies my preferences, right? It gives me like economic and cultural permission to want what I want and to prefer what I prefer, which is then a perfect kind of ontology or perfect way of seeing to fuel a planetary capital system. And you know, Joe talks about instead conceiving of the human in terms of values, right? Which perhaps could lead to a very different kind of operating system. Whereas in the Buddhist world, often we talk about just letting go of what you want. You know, there's two ways to get what you want: to get what you want or to stop wanting. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's kind of two ways out of that trap. But it does seem to me that it's important to call out both liberalism and humanism together as being kind of primary obstacles to, what we say, like uninstalling some of the ways of being that are causing the destruction of the biosphere.
Philosophers have taken quite some time to analyze what liberalism is, but let's just take the understanding provided by your friend Joe. Let's say liberalism proposes the idea that human beings are preference maximizers of some kind or another, or that our desires are immediately sanctified or validated. It's worth asking ourselves, how is that build, that picture, even possible? It's only possible if it's the case that there's already been the demise of anything upon which my life stands, or upon which it rests, or over against which it leans. I have to presuppose that there's an immediate stamp of approval on a desire or a preference, because there is nothing else. that's another way of putting this is that nihilism is the condition of possibility for the liberal picture so described. It's only in that way, do you see what I mean? It's only in that way that I can not ask myself, oh, I have the desire to do this, ergo I shall do it. No, I've already given it, I've already signed off on it. It's only if I say, ah, oh, desires are not always justified because there is, dare I say, something higher to which my life responds. Right, it is God to let my will be thy will, O God. Right, Saint Benedict in his marvelous guide or rule or trellis invites practitioners in the monastic institution he helped to found to go on a path of humility. Humility isn't quite the same as a Buddhist concept, but it's the emptying out of self-will, you might say, in order that one can have one's will be the will of God. That's only possible on the grounds that there is a higher existence for us, that to which we respond, that which animates us most. So it is fair to say that liberal humanism come together if we allow the bridge to be nihilism. There is nothing else. There is nothing more.
Yeah, and I so appreciate. I think that the looking at this historically, as you do in your article, and as other thinkers, like we had Jeremy Johnson on the show, and talked about Jean Gebser's analysis, which I think is really lines up quite nicely with what we're exploring right now, but that it's good to know the historical nature and the dialectic of how we came to have this mind that can destroy the biosphere, like that is like an affordance of this mind that has been created by virtue of circumstance and historical unfolding. And so that's like one conversation I think is really important to have. And if you're like listening, I think that's useful to explore, to add dimensionality to this. But the place I want to, I think, go with you more is like, what are our prospects of actually unwinding that way of being in the world and part of me wants to say like in a reasonable time frame. You know, speaking personally, I've been more or less dedicated to self-transformation for, you know, the better part of a decade, not full time, but with a lot of my time. And like, I feel like I'm just escaping some of the worst pieces of liberal humanism and the hold it's had over my psyche. And so there's 7 billion of us, and altogether, we're kind of we're generating this planetary operating system. How do you hold that urgency with like the speed at which these psychotechnologies tend to work?
I don't know. I don't think we do yet know. But let's give it a try, right? I happen to think the following. There needs to be what I call an existential opening first. This is a personal example, but I'll use it to illustrate the broader point. There was a man I philosophize with individuals different parts of the world on a daily basis, and I was speaking with a man yesterday, and he was telling me about his sister-in-law. His sister-in-law is very stubborn indeed by his lights, and yet she's also causing unnecessary suffering to her son and to her husband and his brother, not to say also the rest of the family. And I just pointed out that if it is the case that she's recalcitrant, then it's probably the case that she has yet to genuinely experience an existential opening.
Hmm.
Therefore, you're barking up the wrong tree. You need to turn to those who have been existentially open. So it might help to know what that means. By existential openness, I mean the actual experience of being cracked open by life in such a way that the questions are now turned back on you. That is, most of the questions we ask are what Advaita Vedanta would call objective in nature. They're questions just about economics or just about politics or in a way just about psychology. I would call that an objective investigation in a certain respect. We have to turn the question back and ask, who am I?
Hmm.
Who is the one who is talking about economics just now? Who is the one who is concerned about politics? That is the beginning of, properly speaking, introspection. So if I may take a shot at answering your question, I might very delicately refer to some of the shock tactics used by crazy wisdom adepts in George Feuerstein's book, Holy Madness, one that you and I were talking about a little bit over Twitter the other day. It's a very delicate matter, because in this particular scenario, you have a spiritual teacher and you have a disciple or student. In that dynamic, under the aegis of the crazy wise adept, it is permissible for the teacher to engage in shock tactics in order, as Feuerstein says, to induce or arouse in the student the kind of situation that will lead to, quote, a spiritual crisis.
Mm.
So I think we're getting close to something that wouldn't look quite as crude and potentially vicious as some of these shock tactics have been in these particular contexts. But if I may just take a shot at answering your question, I would say that we would need to perhaps engage in some form of gentle shock, and that's an oxymoron by design, in order to help people get closer and closer and as quickly as possible to spiritual crisis. So that's a go. What do you think?
Yeah, what occurs to me is that perhaps like the burning of Australia and things like that could serve such a function, especially as they happen more and more often. I wonder if those planetary events will start to function as sort of existential questions for the collective, you know, looking on and in at these events.
I don't know yet, right? We've had a number so far. What I'm suggesting is something slightly stronger, just for the sake of this conversation. We're jamming together. I mean it earnestly, but I also don't know whether this is the way. But when I philosophize with someone, it is the case that I'm often pushing that person to the point of realizing a truth and therefore no longer being able to turn away from something. I'm not doing it, I hope, in a way that it's mean or cruel or nasty or self-interested. It's just the case that I have the intuition that there's something here for this person, and I'm willing to push and push and push to a point at which that person turns toward it and sees it. Obviously, this is an I-thou relationship. And so your question is a question of scale, but I'm trying to suggest the possibility that the earth on its own is not anthropomorphically turning itself into the teacher and pointing these questions at most people in such a way that they are being so shocked by them that they are, in a non-Buddhist key, woken up to them. I'm just wondering to what extent human beings might need to mediate
right
that relationship, or you might even say facilitate it. So you could imagine a situation in which, let's say, these gentle provocateurs are dropped down into Australia, and somehow there are actual models or designs set up to get people to the point of really feeling the grief and sorrow and despair associated with the fires that were burning around them and may still be burning around them, so that it doesn't just become a technological problem to be solved. It becomes something that has to, as I would say, touch the heart. It really has to pierce the heart so that it can bring about the possibility of metanoia, which is change of heart or conversion, conversion of heart. That's where the psychotechnologies or life practices come in. They are meant to pierce us. And I might just add here, now that I'm getting a little bit excited, I don't think we should think about spirituality, if that's what we want to use here, as being something that calms and mollifies. It's not. It's something that incites and it brings. Zen here is very, Rinzai Zen is very good in this sense. Basho says that, or Boshan rather, says that we should try to arouse the great doubt. That's what meditation is. It's arousing the great doubt. So there's room now, perhaps, for actually arousing people, but not in the way that, let's say, just social activists have, but in the way that they can actually feel in the most intimate chambers of their being the sorrow and suffering and despair and hollowness that abounds.
Yeah, what's occurring to me too is that it's fun to geek out about what is the right ecology of transformational practices. Like, I really enjoy that conversation. And I have a degree of faith that once somebody experiences the kind of existential opening that you're referring to, that they'll kind of find their way over a long enough time horizon. And in the meantime, they're generally vectoring towards more ethical behavior. Like, that's a kind of, like, I don't know if that's actually true. Maybe I might just discovered a belief that's not helpful, but I have that sense. And so hearing you, it's like, yeah, there's a way in which this existential opening is more the name of the game than creating these ecologies of practice almost. Because once your head has been broken open, once your heart's been broken open, like, good luck getting in their way. At least that was true for me and for many people that I know. You know, there's no stopping it.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. This is why Gurdjieff says man is living in a dream. The first question is, you're right, we've been talking a little bit about this on Twitter. The first question is not how do we design the best ecology of practices. The first question is, how do we precipitate or arouse the kinds of openings that will thereby allow people to open their eyes to the self-transformative practices that are becoming available to us? And I say this because when I philosophize with people, I'm mainly looking for whether or not they have had some kind of existential opening. They are in the midst of one, or they are close to one. That's more or less the main question that I'm asking when I'm having initial calls with them before we even embark on the possibility of philosophizing together. Because otherwise it's just mental masturbation or intellectualization. There's no point in talking about the nature of God if you haven't been completely rattled by whether or not God exists. It's uninteresting and beside the point to engage in questions about theism or atheism or whatever. It's just not, it's completely beside the point. It's only when someone says, my God, I have no idea whether God exists, and that means seemingly everything to me, and I can't even put this into words, that person really becomes alive to animated, vibrating, pulsing questions. Mm. And so I'm aware that my experience, I'm aware that both of the interestingness of the approach to existential openness and of its potential limitations, in as much as I don't really know what it would be like to try to engage people on a larger scale in this sort of thing.
Right.
That's where you're coming back to the question about the urgency. And here I'm pairing the urgency with existential openness rather than with ecologies of practice.
Yeah. Well, and as you speak, it what comes to mind also is, you know, we just did a week-long circling retreat here at Maple, and you know, that's a relate kind of like we call it a relational meditation practice. And often, a common experience in that setting is seeing that somebody's like on the precipice of an opening and not being able to really act in any way. You can't stand up for them, right? That's one of the, I feel, at least became very clear to me. You can kind like, there's very subtle ways in which you can behave that don't obstruct that opening, which is becoming, which is kind of like opening up in front of them. But, the degree to which we can actually help each other, say, have an existential opening is, I would love to hear you reflect on this. Like, how to what degree can we actually support that happening? Because it, I am at least at this point a little bit pessimistic about it.
Francis Lucille is a contemporary Advaita Vedanta teacher. And he thinks that apropos enlightenment or self-realization, it is basically a matter of grace. Let me be clear, though. He doesn't suggest that there are sadhanas or practices or forms of self-inquiry. He does. But I think he's right to say that at some point, the absolute or the nameless absolute, or capital C consciousness, or Buddha nature, or whatever you wish to call it, issues an invitation, and the person who is not a person, so to say, says yes to the invitation, or is not yet ready to say yes. That seems to be about right from a structural point of view, when we look back to your question. We have at our disposal, first of all, discernment. You look around and you see, you start to get a sense of which people are close to being, as it were, switched on. You can feel that, I think. It's not always clear, but you can get a sense or a taste of it. There's an intuition. So then you start with those people, let's say. And then you're involved in some kind of practice that is paradoxically gentle yet unrelenting. And its point and purpose is to bring someone to that ineffable moment when there is the possibility of a genuine opening. And then it's a matter of grace, as it were. Will that, it's completely, all bets are off at that point. We don't know, Hakawan calls it don't know mind. We don't know whether that person will turn toward the opening and say yes, or we'll turn away. We don't know that for the whole group either. The reason I'm sanguine about that is this is from the Bhagavad Gita and from the Lojong training. Bhagavad Gita says we have a right to our action, but not to the fruits of our action. The mind training manual says abandon all hope of results. Both do not say do not act if action is meet and appropriate to do. They say, this is a very Buddhist nature, we must act with a view to the possibility that so-and-so shall be existentially open, but knowing full well that that is A, completely unknowable, and B, let me put it this way, quite miraculous. You can see I don't mind some Christian language, but by miraculous I mean that it is beyond the purview of our present knowledge, and it comes as a kind of beautiful surprise, if it does come as a beautiful surprise. And by beautiful, I don't also mean horrifying. It could be that too. So that's the way I understand it. The short version is you can lead a horse to water, but you can't teach it to drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd be curious to hear more about, at least based on what you're saying, I imagine that, and I think you said this earlier, that you are often in the position where you're helping people, supporting people as they wayfind their way towards this existential opening. And it seems to me that philosophical conversation may be one of the best kind of quote unquote psychotechnologies to afford that movement. And that, as you say, afterwards, there might be a whole ecology that opens up into, but that before you have that existential opening, you know, those may or may not be so useful. And so I would be interested in hearing a bit more about what you've discovered in terms of like what works, like what have you discovered through your discernment and through your practice and supporting others that might be supportive to me and to listeners who may have people in their lives who are on the precipice or are kind of, you know, getting ripe, we might say.
Let me describe the context first. Imagine it's possible for two people, whether they're in person or living elsewhere, to set aside all time constraints. They will have a conversation and they will not know how long it lasts, but they will know exactly when it will begin. That's the Zen. The Zen part is the exact part of when it begins. All right. That's very important, I think, for a whole host of reasons. But one is that it actually brings us to genuine presence. There is nothing we are saying to one another. There's nothing more important than the I thou. There's nothing more important than this. And we're also saying to ourselves, we will bracket any ideas of the past and the future, because the presupposition is that we don't know how long it lasts. And that not knowing how long it lasts, it creates that kind of energy or verve or even a kind of tension, you might say. So that's the first thing. Then imagine it's the case that one person accepts the responsibility of being the answer, and the other person accepts the responsibility of being the questioner. I usually play the role of the questioner in these conversations. That's not like an interviewer-interviewee relationship. It's even though it's the case that one is typically asking questions, the other is typically supplying answers. Because in this case, the questioner does not know what he or she is going to ask beforehand, but it shall be a clear, jargon-free, well-specified, truth-seeking question. And the answer is in a position, this would take a while to spell out, of seeking only to say what he or she believes to be true or could be true. Therefore, we've also bracketed, more phenomenological language here, we've also bracketed the desire to please or the desire to say what is nice or flattery or circumlocution or any kind of indirect manner. It's just an inquiry into the truth. That's it. Whatever is the case. So far so good. Then the key is that the questioner has to come to a point of a kind of courage mixed with deep inquisitiveness, because he or she's, and this is the way I practice, is looking for what I call a matter of existential weight. So the conversation begins very easily. How are you doing? The person says, I'm doing just fine, right? It begins an ordinary discourse. But then over the course of the questioning and answering, it very slowly turns toward mystery. And the mystery is that something is of existential weight here. It's hard to even say more in terms of a definition. There is something here for the answerer that the answerer knows not and the questioner knows not. But the questioner comes to a point of realizing that there's a neighborhood, so to speak, in which there is a matter of existential weight. It is implicit in what that person has said but has yet to say. Right, we know this. We watch it when it's the case. We see someone answer a question, and it didn't quite do it for us. Something was unsatisfactory about the answer, or there was something hinted at, or alluded to, or talked around. So once we know there's a matter of existential weight, then we just dwell there. We ask questions, as it were, around it. And the key is that if all this goes well, then there is an articulation, what I call a existential truth. It's a very simple statement from the heart. I must leave her. I do not love him. Although it's not very dramatic, but, you know. Okay, here's one from a recent conversation. After all the complications of all the convolutions and all the sophistications of the rational mind, we finally come to what we're getting at, which is what I call the heart. So the heart speaks an existential truth. And she said, from a very young age, I was led to believe, this is a paraphrase, that there was something wrong with me because I was too quiet. And we just started crying. Because we could kind of, as a gestalt, see and feel what had happened. You know, this is the first conversation I'd had with her. I could feel it now. It's just, there's welling up behind my eyes. It's not sentimentality. There's a truth that was just uttered. So that, when she says that, and that's not the only kind of existential truth one could say, then she's participating in the existential opening at the same time that she's opening the door, as it were, even more. So the conversation, I wish, it's hard to mimic these things. They're art performances, as it were. But what's really quite fascinating about them is they have a kind of texture or atmosphere. And we know this when we're in good conversations. They begin to have a kind of gravitas. There's a crackle. There's a crackle in the air as we move further and further into the mystery. And the key is that because the questioner has agreed to be the questioner only, and the answer has agreed to be the answer only, and because there's no time and there are few other guidelines, then they're fully willing, heart willingly, entering into the mystery without having to say, oh, time's up, or oh, we're turning away, or oh, that's that, or no, we're here for as long as we're here. That might be 3 hours after we open our eyes and look at the clock later on. So you're right to say that when someone begins to have enough of those tastes, right, or the perfumes of existential truths, and that person really keeps ripening and ripening and ripening. This is not the only, as it were, psychotechnology, of course, to bring this about, not at all, but it's the one that I'm most familiar with, because it's the one that I've been involved in for about a decade now. I see what happens to people in ways that are basically ineffable, i.e. I see what happens to their dispositions, and more than their dispositions, owing not to any particular subject we talk about, but rather to the way in which it continues to unfold. So even though I gave answers there according to a content-rich answer, that is, I felt that there was something wrong with me, that something was that I was too quiet, that I've been living with that through all these days of my life. That is a content-rich answer, but there's also the way or the atmosphere or the something around which all that was said that made all the difference.
Yeah, I get a sense of the flavor or the scent of what it is that you're speaking towards. And I know in my own life, I wasn't lucky enough to have like a conversational partner, like the one that you're talking about. I think you are for many people, it sounds like. And so a lot of it I did on my own, I think, kind of unearthing these existential truths and then honoring them by changing my life, which seems like that's one of the keys, is like acknowledging them and then living according to them, that then propels you forward and puts you in a position to go beyond yourself in a way that you can then make use of, like, say, an ecology of practices, like what we have here at Maple, or what other people, other traditions are experimenting with, or what you write about.
I think what you said there was a really important and beautiful addition, namely that the existential truths are simply the starting points for the further inquiry into how to live in accordance with what has there been articulated.
Yes.
So I like to talk about living in the light of an existential truth, and living out hitherto unforeseeable life implications. That is, neither of us knew what it would be like when we articulated existential truth X to live in the light of X. But there has to be what Alain Badiou calls a fidelity, a faithfulness to living in the light of the existential truth, even without knowing what it will mean for you or where it will take you. It may take you to being a monastic, and you didn't see that 5 years ago. To make it even realer, I'd also like to say that when one has a flash of an existential truth, as when one wakes up in the middle of the night or out of a dream and says something or hears something, but when one turns away from that articulation and says, oh, it was nothing, or it didn't really mean anything, or what a weird experience that was a few days ago or a month ago, I call that betrayal.
Yeah.
So what we're imagining, there would need to be ways of trying to make it more likely that people having uttered existential truths would be faithful to them. We're talking about probabilities here, if we're turning to the burning fires in Australia. Because my sense is that it's a lot easier to betray them and turn around, and the rational mind will say again, oh, it wasn't that important after all, or what a weird fun experience that was, that one time I took psychedelics, and how curious of a thing it was. So basically I'm putting my cards on the table by saying I have a kind of mystical view of life. And the mystical view of life suggests that there are these ruptures of sorts. Those ruptures are the conditions of possibility for new life, for rebirth. Mm-hmm. They're that which we need to follow. But too often we see them as not being, so to speak, signs, but rather as being just curious experiences we had. Or maybe we're spiritual materialists and we fetishize them into a spiritual resume of sorts. Yeah. But that's not what they're doing. They're calls, you might say, from the absolute. They're yanking us. They're yanking us toward new life, if only we allow them to.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. One thing that comes to mind, and this has been echoing in me as I begin this inquiry in the podcast, because one of the things I'm keen to do is offer critiques of the kind of modern spiritual culture. And this line from Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke, keeps coming up of, you must change your life. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's something that we talk about a lot here at Maple, is like, you know, on the Eightfold Noble Path, like right livelihood is where the rubber hits the road. It's the bottom of the wheel. And there's a degree to which, like, a lot of, and you even say it, like, you know, there are different philosophies or ways of living through which you can interpret an existential opening that will then neuter it and its power that it might have to change your life, the power that you could give it. You know, maybe you see it as a pathology. Maybe you put it up on a mantle as a kind of spiritual materialism. Like, I've done this before. I had an insight in meditation, and I didn't honor the insight, right? I was like, oh, wow, what a beautiful insight. And then, you know, I put it in a box and kept it somewhere where I could make an identity out of it. And we could do all these things with our openings. And so I think one of the aspects I really appreciate about your work is that you're pointing to really clear philosophies, and almost, I would even like say, metaphysics, that support people through this process and doesn't make it as easy to sacrifice our openings on like the altar of whatever philosophy we typically unwittingly paying homage to. Because I think that's part of the other issue, is that so often these philosophies have power over us. We don't even know that we're a liberal humanist, for instance.
Mm-hmm. This is why the one technology I'm most familiar with is the philosophical conversation. We just know that if both people are really in it, then there's no way that the questioner, the philosophical guide, is going to give too much slack or beg off showing up the next time. I mean, I'm not speaking here about quote unquote accountability. Just speaking, though we could use that word, I suppose. I'm speaking about the fact that something has happened to that one, to the other, to the answer. Some time has elapsed between conversation number one, say, and conversation number two. But provided that person shows up again, here the questioner is again. Right? The question arises again, are you living in fidelity with or in the light of what has been understood? And it's not out of keeping score or keeping tabs. It's out of love. You know that if you're right to quote Sloterdijk and Rilke here, you must change your life. But it would also be fair to say that there's a kind of love that makes that much more possible. When someone says, oh yes, I must change my life, and I am loved. There's loving kindness that is exhibited through questioning, say, that is urging me, that is yearning for me to do so. That won't beg off, that won't go away. People misunderstand Socrates. He wanted us to change our lives. He kept asking questions. He kept going around and putting people to a point of what the Greeks called aporia, which is usually translated as mental confusion, but could be translated as a pathless path.
Mm.
The question first turns you around. It dizzies you. It disorients you. But it does so that you can't so easily go back to the map that you'd been utilizing so readily. Mm. And once you know that you can't, once you've had so many experiences in which you can't go back to that map or those coordinates or those quote tools or whatever, but once you've also become accustomed to the uncertainty of living in the interregnum, living in between, then your willingness to step forward onto the path increases immensely. But all that was just to try to say something about how you must change your life is illuminated by or surrounded by love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I had something happening over the last couple of minutes where I was struck by, like, we started the conversation talking a little bit about psychotechnologies or ecologies of practices, and we're like, well, you know, before you can really make best use of these practices, you need to have an existential opening first, or one must have an existential opening first. And then it occurs to me, well, you could go before that. It's like, but the real question is, how do we kind of quote unquote make there be more existential openings? Mm-hmm. But then you could go before that and say, like, what brings somebody to an existential opening? You know, what comes before that? And how do we bring people to whatever's before that? And what, you know, there's a sort of like a little bit of a turtles all the way down line of thinking in my head right now. And then it quickly popped up, like, oh, well, that's why we need a new culture, right? And that we need a new milieu to swim in that sort of just gently supports us along this path of ripening into an inevitable existential opening that honors such existential openings, honors psychotechnologies of transformation, and so on and so forth. And so I thought I'd just kind of like name that that was a thing that happened in my head. I would love to hear if you have any reflections on that, but I do also want to talk a little bit more in this latter part of the conversation about, you know, your thinking around how to create a balanced ecology of practices. Anything coming up for you as I share all that?
Yeah, I'll make it brief so that we can turn to the second part. So far, we've imagined that those we call seekers are pretty weird creatures existing on the fringes of various social orders. But we could ask ourselves, is our time such that we actually need seekers to be embedded in culture in a way that wouldn't make them seem like freaks or weirdos or strange people? If that were true, then we'd have a culture of seeking. And there would be perhaps some kind of stadial analysis, according to which there would be times in one's life when one is at different points of seeking. I'm not attached to the use of the word seeking here. I'm just using it as a placeholder for a different understanding of a human being that needs to grow and develop and evolve in different stages and in different ways. And I think that might help to set up the second part of our conversation today.
Hmm. Yeah. And I realize as you're speaking, I have something, I think I'm, this is implicit in my belief system that I'm now making explicit here with you, that in the right conditions, every human being would be a quote unquote seeker, that is like more natural. And the very fact that it happens in systems in which it's largely tempered is a demonstration of how irrepressible that impulse is. And so when I think of creating a new education system, I for me, it's like, and this is somewhat inspired by the work of Zach Stein, it's like, how do we create an education system that allows that to burst forth, that quote-unquote seeking to burst forth in every human heart?
My succinctest reply would be to say that we've gotten what a human being is pretty much all wrong in modernity. The wrong view is the human being is, roughly speaking, an active creature seeking to work on the world. That would take us into a discussion of what I call total work. Hmm. The right view, is that a human being fundamentally is a contemplative creature opened up to the mystery of everything that is. That's closer to what it is to be a child growing up in a good enough household, to use D.W. Winnicott's term here, than it is to what we think about as someone being pressed through institutionalization with a view of that person becoming a functionary, as Joseph Pieper called it. So imagine instead that we begin from the axiom that human beings are fundamentally contemplative. And that means, I don't know what this is all about. I don't know why I'm here, whatever here is. And I don't know, and I certainly don't know who I am. Okay, start there. That's our birthright. And then a culture surrounds, affords, enables those kinds of questions, pursuits, and practices to emerge very organically.
Yes, yes. Beautiful. Yeah, I love that answer to what is the human. And so there's also, in my mind, there's this time that we're in now is, I really appreciate Zach Stein's phrase that we're in a time between worlds, right? That we're in this time of crisis when a lot of the ways of being that we've taken for granted are starting to fall apart. And it does seem, at least from my perspective and the perspective of many people I've spoken with, that we're kind of at a choice point. Humanity's at a choice point. We could, I would say, make good decisions and arrive at a kind of ecological civilization that takes on a new understanding of what the human is, perhaps the one that you've already offered, or we could make bad decisions and basically destroy the biosphere, create a kind of post-apocalyptic world, of which there are many and some are worse than others. But in general, you know, civilization goes down and takes much of life on this planet with it. And so there's this interesting question of like, you know, what is that world, if we make the good choices, going to be? Perhaps we see the human as a contemplative creature. But then there's also this kind of intermediary question is like, who do we need to become now in order to make that happen? Which maybe is a different question, or maybe it isn't. But I'm curious for you how that lands in you. Like, is the, yeah, how do you hold that?
Can you ask it once more?
Yeah. So there's a really beautiful idea of like, what is the education system and culture that would surround the understanding that the human is a contemplative creature? That seems different to me than the education system and culture we need to create now, which is in part an attempt to answer the question, like, how do we navigate this critical transitionary time on the planet? At least that seems like that could be the case to me. Like, we need to create a particular kind of human right now that can help us get to the point where we can create this like broadly kind of contemplative human culture. But maybe not. I don't know. These are thoughts.
I'm with you. Why don't you take a first go at it? Because I think we were talking about wise leaders at Maple. Mm-hmm. It sounds as if that's your provisional answer.
Well, that's the answer at Maple. And I'm a little bit agnostic about whether that's the right answer or not. To some degree that this podcast inquiry is now sensing into that question. It does seem to me that if we want to create a broadly transformed culture, that in order to do that, we would in the near term need to somehow create people who can create situations in which they gain a lot of power and can then allocate that power to the emergence of this kind of nascent culture. Like, there needs to be some kind of actual power shift. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of happening. Like, I see it happening slowly. But, you know, the people with their hands on the levers of power in all the various places in our society and culture, like, it's not clear to me that they're going to just, like, have an existential opening and relinquish, you know, their hold on the throat of the biosphere or whatever. And so there's kind of these complexities of transition that I think in that space, yeah, maybe what we need to create now is like very powerful, determined, relentless kind of leaders who are really determined to make critical changes no matter what. And then, like, in order to get to a future where we can all just sort of like be a lot more chill and like love each other in this kind of different and less kind of with less of like a teleology trying to get, or like objective trying to get to a different world.
I'll take your suggestion and run with it. So the suggestion is that power needs to become, or some who are in positions of power need to become wise in order for us to make the transition to a more contemplative world.
Yeah. Well, so maybe if I can interject just a little piece. So we often at Maple will say, we want to bring wisdom to those in power and power to those with wisdom. Hmm. It's kind of two moves that I think we're wanting. But yeah, so that you're getting it right. I just wanted to put that other piece in there too.
Well, there are two parts that we're considering. The first is the part about power, which maybe we can look at together. And the second part is the bit about wisdom, which is the part that I'm more familiar with. So let's think about what wisdom is. We could begin by claiming that wisdom has to do with conduct. That is, with how one conducts oneself in the world. If we begin there, then we can ask ourselves, what is wisdom based on or flowing from? And I think that wisdom is based on or flowing from right understanding. So we can say that a wise person just is wise just in case he or she is conducting him or herself in a way that is flowing directly from right understanding. Listeners might wonder, who cares about the who cares about the definition, right? But we need definitions at their best are meant to simply illuminate the kinds of inquiries and practices that we need. So if we're thinking about how to cultivate wise persons, just insofar as their conduct is saturated by their understanding, then we need practices that help to enhance their understanding, as well as those who help to show them the path from their understanding to the ways they conduct themselves. So that by my lights is the starting point. If I think about what it is for a philosopher, be involved in philosophia, it is for someone to be involved in the loving pursuit of living a wise life. This means that this person cares so deeply about how he or she conducts himself on his own behalf or on her own behalf, with others, with all sentient beings, that the person goes back one step and asks, what is it upon which my compassion is based? What is that which suffuses courage here and now with the status of being courage? Why am I acting courageously now as opposed to peaceably or in some other fashion? So we're just trying to see that wisdom takes within itself an incredible onus or burden or responsibility to it, that it's the understanding that, I don't like the word informs here, it pulses, the understanding pulses through the conduct drenching the conduct in what is most needful here and now.
Yeah. I mean, I love that so much, and you know, it's. I think it's really important that we define wisdom, or at least kind of reflect on what we want it to mean, because at least in the circles of meditation practice that I have swam in earlier in my life, wisdom has almost had in those spaces become a kind of like phenomenological shift, right? It was like the correction of a bug in our perception, essentially. And it was seen, or, and even I think it was thought that the idea that behavior change was part of wisdom was like an antiquated and almost like mythological vision for human transformation. And I am just so done with that personally. Like, I am much more turned on by a vision of wisdom, which is eminently practical and has everything to do with ethics and how we live our life, like every day.
And it is not just more interesting, it's more real. When you read some of the literature, or you read the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita, and the word wisdom is mentioned, I'm not a scholar here, I must say, on these texts, you just find that they are, they feel often ungrounded. They feel as if it just occurs whenever one is enlightened or self-realized. As you said, it's an epiphenomenal. Well, you're enlightened now, you're wise. Well, but it ain't so. I mean, you're able to see the world differently. You're able to the understanding is it has been shifted, but it doesn't follow that you know necessarily how to be compassionate. So let's take a simple example. We'll take two examples. We know that if someone is enlightened, it doesn't follow that person is going to be the best pianist in the world. If that person hadn't been a great pianist before. We know this, but you hear some talk about siddhis, or these amazing powers that accrue to the one who's enlightened or self-realized. And you come to think that, mythologically so, that the someone who is enlightened will thereby be able to be an excellent piano player. But this is an Aristotelian remark, and the Aristotelian remark it goes to the actual fact, namely that if you're going to be wise, there are all these situations that accrue over and over again in which one is invited to act in the light of your best understanding, which is thereby, as I said, drenching and saturating your action to the full. And that doesn't come with enlightenment alone, though enlightenment certainly makes one's attention better. It certainly allows one to key into what is most salient. But it doesn't follow that one is thereby going to act with upaya, is going to be able to use skillful means. And I'm offering a corrective to what I've heard when I've been around certain spiritual teachers who seem to take the view that one will simply come to conduct oneself in the light of consciousness or awareness, is it capital A, capital C, or Buddha nature, in virtue of enlightenment. And it's so far as I can tell, it's not so, because it's the incorrect understanding of what it's like for a human being to be wise. Aristotle, I think, is closer to the mark. That is, if you want to be courageous, this is going to blow your mind here, you probably need to be in situations where they're fear-inducing and you act for the sake of the good rather than out of fear. Whoa, right? I mean, it's not surprising that you become to be a more courageous person if it were the case that you were in situations where you felt the fear. Maybe there's a felt sense of fear, if you want to go there. You felt sense of fear arises. You know what is good or right or meet to do, and courage is precisely the virtue that enables one not to act out of fear, but rather for the sake of the good in the face of fear. so I hope this doesn't sound like an ungrounded part of the conversation. You can bring it back to contexts in which you have people in positions of power. And imagine time and time again, you're presenting them with cases, scenarios, and situations, often from their own life, but sometimes hypothetical, in which they're coming to a finer-grained feeling and understanding of not just themselves, but of whatever is salient in the situation, perhaps beyond the situation, as it were, in the real world. And this enfolding of their understanding in a kind of newfound depth as well as simplicity then becomes the condition of possibility for their ability to tune themselves into it so as to act or conduct themselves from it. So that would be my different understanding of wisdom. It doesn't just fall from the sky upon realization.
Yeah. I mean, I notice like my body relaxing as you say that, because I think it's funny, because I used to say it's one of the most important things that we in the West have learned about kind of broadly like human development in the last whatever it is, 60 years, is that enlightenment doesn't take care of things like character development per se. But it's funny, you know, the West might have only realized in the past 60 years, but as I'm sure you know, like Zen history is full of movements realizing this and creating schools and systems based on this understanding that enlightenment without character development or without a system, an education system, which compels you in many cases to be ethical, is incomplete. And so, you know, it's good that we're catching up with that. And I think I agree completely. The kind of image that came to me as you were speaking is like a development vectoring towards awakening is sort of like the crown jewel, but that there needs to be other pieces present in order for everything to function. And I think what's coming to me too is that, and I don't think that you listed this, but it's implicit in your list of suggested psychotechnologies, is that we need to really explicitly work mm-hmm. on virtues, living according to virtues. And maybe a better way of saying what I was trying to say before is that we're moving into, and we are in a time period in which particular virtues need to be amplified. And I think, as you say, perhaps courage is just such one of those virtues. And so a question then becomes for me, like, how do we create educational systems which really amplify those virtues that we need now to navigate this transition? Yeah.
The first thing I would say is that, if I may paint this in broad strokes, the West hasn't really, Western philosophy hasn't often known how to teach ethics, because it's been tied to a certain Kantian view of morality, and as well as to a certain utilitarian view. It's only in the last 30 or so years that virtue ethics, which you were just pointing to, has come back on the scene with a book such as Alistair MacIntyre's After Virtue. And since then, it's been a hot subject. Nonetheless, virtue ethics is still an academic subject, and in that sense is talked about rather than being practiced. So the second point I would make is that I'm a firm believer, based on experience, in a medieval view of casuistry or case history. According to this view, people learn ethics through thick, rich cases. Some of those cases are often what are called casus perplexi, which is perplexing cases, cases of conscience, cases when you don't know how to morally assess them, or you don't know what to do in light of them. And I think that's more or less what happens through certain philosophical conversations on an ad hoc basis, that is, someone's presented with a number of different cases or contexts in his or her life, and then there's just a very lengthy discourse about them. The discourse is not meant to be long-winded. It's meant to provide one with what I before I was calling a fine-grained understanding. So the first part is how do we, the first part is allowing people to, in and through the educational systems you're alluding to, come to fine-grained understanding of the kinds of virtues that need to be exercised. The next point that listeners might not be familiar with is that virtue is most often spoken about in an Aristotelian context, and sometimes it's defined as doing the right thing in the right way with the right reason for the right aim. So it's context or situation based, and it requires a certain kind of moral perception. And the next point we can ask, or the next matter we can consider, is which virtues are most salient for our time. And for a while now, I've thought that courage is one of the most salient virtues. I would say actually courage and truthfulness at this point. I used to think of courage and patience, or courage and compassion, or courage and openness, but I'm kind of hinging toward courage and a kind of radical truthfulness here. Consider the former, though. You asked before, then how would we begin to cultivate in an educational setting the virtue of courage? And I think that's, in broad strokes, pretty easy. I'm not saying actually doing is easy, but talking about it is easy enough. You just begin to become as clear as possible about which fears someone has. So I'm not of the view that courage is identical with fearlessness, right? The ancients and them thought that courage was numerically identical with fearlessness. But that's not right. If you're fearless, you don't need courage. You're just competent. If you had a godlike ability to do X, then you wouldn't need courage to do X. You would just do X. So courage arises because your knowledge or capacities are there are limits to your knowledge or capacities. So you're thrown back on the fact that I feel fear. Wonderful. So now we have any number of contemplative practices that allow us to see the fear arise. But then we also need, I think, some kind of discursive practices that allow us to talk about what the ancients would call the good. That for the sake of which one does something. So in my little schema, I have courage as the mediator between fears and the good. And courage is therefore what enables one to fully acknowledge fear is there. Right? That's why I said before, you act in the face of fear, but for the sake of the good. So that is what you're learning. You're learning to love the good. It's just so you can come up with a similar analysis by which you'd find yourself loving what is true, even in the face of fear or resistance. And usually the word there is resistance. So you love to be in the way of truth, and you love to speak the truth so far as you're able, even or especially in the face of resistance. Schematically, it's not that hard to understand how you train someone. You just keep presenting. It's like deep learning, right? You just give them more and more cases of pattern recognition to the point in which they get very skilled at it. So somehow the person would need to discover what he or she is very afraid of or terrified by. Yeah, because the first answer is not usually the best one. The first one is usually tends to be something of a dodge. You know, when you're speaking with people in ordinary conversation, you ask them how they're doing, they say, I'm doing fine. Well, it's not necessarily untrue. And then maybe that's all that you would also, that might be just as far as you would go with a person in ordinary conversation. But your sense of smell tells you that that wasn't really the most truthful answer.
Yeah. Well, and so, I really appreciate this, the conversation we've had, Andrew's, as I said at the beginning, I was struck by how similar our inquiries are when I read your article, and it's just like more and more deeply I'm seeing that that's true in this conversation. And I just had a really beautiful vision of like a network of educational centers in which like different cocktails of virtues are being amplified. And there's something just so beautiful about that possible future. And
It doesn't feel that far off, but it also feels very far off. And yeah, I'm curious if there's any thing that you'd like to share as we draw this conversation to a close.
Well, I guess there is. There was the sound of our voices during the conversation today. There was also what we said. But what I was feeling throughout many parts of the conversation is that I was on the verge of tears. And so when I say on the verge of tears, I just mean moved by a kind of poignancy, and not necessarily identical with what was being said, or with how it was being said, but with something that we probably needn't put our finger on, but was of the most central importance. And so thank you very much for the conversation today. I really was very, very moved by it, very touched by it. And I'm glad that we had it today.